Thank you very much, Andrew. How on earth do you follow that and try and sum this up? Answer, I'm not going to try to, but what I do want to do is try and pull together some currents through the conversations that I've heard today, but also I've been hearing elsewhere this week, last month. I think we don't realise, in this room there's the makings of an absolutely brilliant network of people. Because of who you are, not because of the organisations you represent or because of the hats you wear, but because of the individuals you are. And I think my first point is start by understanding your own capacity to make the changes that you think are important in this debate. I want to say a word about what the Centre's work signifies in the first year. Many of you will know about the Allender series of events, tail end of last year, led by Wendy Alexander, Brian Ashcroft and their colleagues, looking at Scotland's economic future. In many ways, a world-class series of speakers and ideas marshalled for the future of Scotland. And indeed, Wendy was discussant at the Richard Layard Lecture for the Centre back in April. I think what the Centre's done in the first year has been of equal merit for the task of improving health, and I also think it's an international resource that will come to be picked up from abroad pretty quickly. And my thought there really is, how do we integrate the world-class pockets of thinking and indeed practice that will emerge in the economic and the social spheres and the health sphere, rather than having them as separate standalone resources for Scotland. When you have the Federation of Small Businesses in Scotland publishing a report about Scotland's place in the world that says, from a business perspective, the big challenge is health improvement, something's changing in Scotland. Andrew talked about tipping points. Cal has done the same in terms of the confidence and wellbeing agenda. And we had a slide earlier this morning that says, for all our effort and intellectual investment and money and political capital, we haven't had a breakthrough in this area. Well, maybe we're on the verge of a breakthrough in terms of our thinking, what's in the toolbox, and maybe the rest of it is up to how we choose to use those tools, rather than waiting for someone to provide the manual for us for that toolbox. I think the challenge can be summed up in this way. Thinking about organisations for a moment, what do we do in an age when top-down increasingly doesn't work? And people at the executive are tearing their hair out over this thing as well. Top-down usually doesn't work. Bottom-up has many resources and many merits, but it usually doesn't scale up. And this room, I'm sure, is full of people with experience of fantastic local practice whose careers are full of if-onlys and what-ifs. If only we could have made this the basis of a new turn in public policy and practice. You know, if only we could have got those people with the resources and the planning horizons to take notice. We need to find ways of bringing together both top-down and bottom-up in the future. But guess what? We have to add to that something else, which I would describe as inside out, and which Phil has described as the inner work. How often do we sit around partnership tables thinking, if we're absolutely honest, if only you would change, my life would be a hell of a lot easier? Well, what have we started by saying? What do I have to do to make it more likely that they will change, but also that I can bring something different to this conversation? The problem is not partnerships. The problem is the partnerships we've created and the purpose we've given them, and probably the lack of expectation we invest in them and the way in which they operate. So if Andrew's right, and I think he is, about there not being a them anymore, only an us, then that has implications for how we work as individuals and in our organisations. I wanted to throw out a story about the future, which is very much in evidence in the media and in Parliament at the moment, because it's a test case of whether we go forward in fear or in hope, whether we think we are locked into a single trajectory or whether we think we have choices to make. And it's about our demography. Demographic time bombs, intergenerational backlash, the greying of the population, all that stuff. 2 years ago, a projection was made that Scotland's population would fall below 5 million in the year 2009. Last year, on the basis of new projections, that year was 2017. Next year, it could be 2030. There are 2 points here. One is, I missed the point when anyone told us why 5 million matters, apart from as some kind of demographic virility test. And even on the basis of the best projections we've got, even something like our future demography, which one would think was had smaller margins of error than many other things in public policy, even that is wide open. So could Glasgow become a high fertility or a low fertility city in European terms? Will we have a high migration scenario? We could stabilise our current workforce, more or less, despite ageing, if we had over the next 40 years 300,000 new migrants to Scotland. But guess what? We've got 300,000 people at the moment, adults of working age who are not in work. So while First Bus are recruiting Polish people, Latvians, Lithuanians, for many good reasons. We've got our Poles in Cambus, Lang and Pollock, and they're on incapacity benefit. And as I was discussing with Harry a moment ago, for all the tough talk from government about incapacity benefit reform, we're doing next to nothing at a national level for the long-term stock of claimants. We're thinking about the next generation. A prime example of either-or thinking when we should be doing both. So the story we tell ourselves about demography and ageing, we should be saying there are choices here. There's not a single track. And the choices we make depend on the vision we have for Glasgow and for Scotland. I wanted to offer just a few thoughts on one concept that might help to describe our sense of purpose and mission in this debate. And it's what if our task was to enhance the quality and depth of this city's asset base? And we changed our definition of assets away from physical things and financial things towards human things, effectively. And what if our asset base was grown in these ways? Firstly, in the broad sense, resources. If you like, three R's for the new story on health. Resources, first of all. Time, skills, work, money, all these things. Trust, indeed. I'm struck going around Scotland by how often people are now saying there's the wrong kind of money and the right kind of money. The wrong kind of money comes with disproportionate strings attached and a degree of audit and accountability and inspection that is bonkers, absolutely disproportionate, based on a culture of fear and suspicion. It's not that we don't need accountability and audit and these things, it's just that we have chosen just about the worst model of it in the UK one could imagine. Whereas if we put peer groups of professionals in charge of that process, give them the ability to seek forgiveness when things go wrong, not permission to try things differently, perhaps we would move further forward. This is absolutely about the heart of our practice as professionals. My sense is that somehow, without it being the intention of anyone, we have added layer upon layer of confusion and bureaucracy to professionals that results in us not being able to act as the people we want to be, not being the professionals we came into our jobs to become whenever that time point in time was. So the question that Phil posed at our table was, what's going to strip away those layers and let us be motivated, joyful, satisfied in our practice? I don't know the answer to that, but I suspect it has quite a lot to do with the capacity we see in ourselves as individuals, the risks we're willing to take, the mistakes we're willing to own up to in peer groups without it destroying reputations and careers in the process. It's difficult stuff, but I'm sure there's something in there that we're just not getting to at the moment in our cultures of audit and accountability. The second R is relationships, which could span anything indeed. I'm struck by evidence from the OECD that despite big progress in Scotland and Britain. We invest about half what the Nordic countries do in broadly defined family functioning, in ways of enabling family security, relationships, work-life balance, good transitions through pregnancy and infancy. I think that if we could find better ways of investing in those relationships, we would find the health dividends were pretty significant. A specific thing that keeps coming up that we have to find a way of talking about, I think, is what's going on with young people, particularly in secondary schools. Keir Bloomer, who many of you will know from Clack Manager Council, spoke at an event on Monday where jaws dropped when he said, in his view, secondary schooling and the model we have in this country is in a state of terminal dysfunction. That doesn't mean to say it's going to disappear tomorrow, it could take 50 years, but terminal dysfunction, because the purpose we have for it hasn't really changed since the Victorian age. Isn't it within our wit to design a form of schooling for young people that really challenges and really shares responsibility and gives young people a way of creating in their own peer groups and with others a sense of meaning, a sense of authentic learning, to use Phil's phrase, that is more than being schooled in one or two forms of intelligence, which we reflect in the academic curriculum. I'm struck by the words of a former education advisor to Bill Clinton in the first term, who came to Central Scotland and said, in his view, the biggest challenge we face in our secondary schools is the crisis of respect and communication. In his view, in a nutshell, young people want to be liked by their teachers. Teachers want to be liked and do the job that they're doing and feel they've done a good job as professionals. No one is happy, despite the incremental progress we're making with things like exam passes. Who is happy in that kind of system? We are flogging the system when, if we put notions of respect and trust and communication at the heart of what we do, we might find disproportionate gains. The third R, or two of them, are reciprocity and responsibility. Willie Rowe, who many of you know as the newish chair of HIE and of the 21st Century Social Work Inquiry, also spoke at the same event on Monday. He talked about the notion of co-investment or co-production of valued outcomes. In other words, how do we build up an asset base and give incentives to service users and providers?